UK Wine Show, show number 126. Bruce Walker on regulation. On this week's award-winning wine show, we're talking with Bruce Walker on regulation. Bruce's job includes dealing with regulation within Canada, a very highly regulated market.
And in the news, new Bordeaux appellation gets go-ahead, wine auctions send mixed messages, and wine yeast genes are decoded.
G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 126 for the 10th of October, 2008. My name is Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with Bruce Walker. Bruce is Vice President for Government and Industrial Regulations for Vincor, the Canadian arm of Constellation, the world's largest wine company. We talk with Bruce about government regulations and how does the Canadian system work. And in this week's spotlight, we're looking at terroir. Can you taste soil in the wine? Also, in what is becoming a favourite part of the wine show, is this week's quote. Who said, wino forever? Clues throughout the show, answers at the end. But next we have the news with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. The new Côte de Bordeaux appellation has got the go-ahead by the INAO and just needs the Ministry of Agriculture's final seal of approval before it comes into effect for 2008 vintage wines. Assuming it is approved, wine labels with the new appellation will be on the shelves from spring 2009. The four new areas are Côte de Bordeaux Blaye, Côte de Bordeaux Castillon, Côte de Bordeaux Franc and Côte de Bordeaux Cadillac. The appellation covers 1,600 producers who make 120 million bottles, which is about 10% of Bordeaux's production. The idea is that the enlarged but simpler appellation should bring clarity for consumers and increase visibility of the regions, as well as enabling wine merchants to make bigger brands to interest supermarkets and bulk buyers from overseas.
I know that's what they say the reason is, but to be honest, I have no idea whether it's a good idea or not. The question for me is, why did they change this? With around 57 appellation controllers already there, how will another one assist wine buyers? Fair enough, they're going to be bigger. What's next, Jane?
Well, various wine auctions are sending out mixed messages about the economy, with collectors of fine wine in the United States seemingly immune to the economic downturn as record prices are achieved. Domaine de la Romanée Conti, Screaming Eagle and Harlan Estate all went for record prices. The wines were sold by Boston-based auctioneer Skinner. They sold a three-bottle lot of Romanée Conti 1911 for over $20,000 per bottle. That's £11,500 and was three times over the estimate. Two bottles of Screaming Eagle 2005 went for $2,430 apiece. That's £1,382. And three bottles of Harlan Estate 1993 went for $810 a bottle. That's about £461, breaking Sotheby's 2008 record for $655. And other auction houses have seen their wine sales continue to soar. For example, Sotheby's in London, who sold £2.6 million worth of wine in September. And at three annual VDP auctions held in Germany at the end of September, business is booming. Over €5,000 was bid for a bottle of 1949 Riesling, and magnums of a 2007 Egon Müller Riesling went for over €1,000. These VDP auctions are a barometer of the value of top estate wines, both in most recent and older vintages. But over in South Africa, it's a different picture at two of the country's annual high-profile auctions. At the Nederberg auction, sales were down 6% on last year, and the Nedbank Cape Winemakers Guild sale achieved 3% less. The wines at both auctions fetch more modest prices of between £85 to £130 a case, but nevertheless, the decrease in sales does reflect the economic and political uncertainties that are facing South Africans after the resignation of President Mbeki.
With the stock markets going south, it's not the wealthy who are going to be first in line to be hurt, but eventually they will take a hit. I think in the past, oil money's been driving a lot of the top wine prices, and with oil prices decreasing as the world economy goes down the gurgler, I doubt if these prices will be maintained. It'll be interesting to see what happens this year in Bordeaux. Prices have more to do with the world economy than the quality of wine, And so 2008's On Premier campaign will be really interesting. Some of the high-end wines may be as a result of investors taking money out of the bank, trying to decide what to do with them. So they could be looking at investing them in wine as well. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, researchers from the Australian Wine Research Institute have become the first in the world to map the genetic code for wine yeast, which means new strains of yeast can be developed without genetic engineering. As you know, a critical element in the winemaking process is the choice of yeast, which allows producers to tailor-make wines for different market specifications. This new information about the genetic code will be used to develop new strains to produce different aroma profiles, adjust alcohol levels, or produce better flavours. That's all from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories at our website www.3050.co.uk.
Thanks, Jane. For some, the idea of using an inoculated yeast is a movement away from terroir. For them, the land and local indigenous yeasts is the only choice. While it's great that some people do this, other people use specific yeast strains. While in theory all yeast is doing is converting sugar to alcohol, they could, perhaps by selecting less efficient yeasts, make it possible to lower the alcohol level in wine and still maybe retain ripe, jammy flavours. Or they could develop yeasts that can work in lower nitrogen levels, the bane of many winemakers with their stuck fermentations and stressed yeast, creating unpleasant flavours in the wine. Yeast selection is always going on. It doesn't matter if it's in the wild or in a laboratory. But like the Human Genome Project, understanding what the DNA is telling us is not going to be simple or easy. We may now own the book containing the genetic code, but we still haven't learnt the language it's written in. Just a quick bit of news, not really important, but just caught my eyes. Inhabitants of the tiny Italian village of Dell'Uva in Marino, south of Rome, thought there'd been a miraculous intervention yesterday when wine started flowing through the taps in their kitchens. Apparently, they hook the winery up to the local fountain at harvest time, so wine flows through the fountains. But this year, the plumbers got it wrong, and wine started pouring out of the taps in people's houses. Talk about turning water into wine. How are you guys going with the quote? Wino forever. This week's quote is rather cryptic. First of all, it wasn't actually said, but written. Well, actually tattooed. More on that later. But it's credited to an American actor born on the 9th of June, 1963, in Kentucky, and is still around today. See how you get on with that. But next up, we have the spotlight, Tasting the Soil, Part 5. While it's possible for a vine to develop unusual flavours due to deficiencies in nutrients, a far more common effect is to change the way the wine feels in your mouth. There are some clear examples where this occurs. It's just that the reasons for it are a bit vague. There are three soils that have demonstrated this effect on wine. They are clay, slate, and limestone. Each have an influence on the texture of the wine. Wines grown on clay tend to exhibit a fatness and a richness. They can feel heavier in the mouth compared with other types of soils. Both Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc express this in New Zealand. Chardonnays grown in Nelson's Mutara Hills have a richness most likely caused by the high clay base. Just at the east of Nelson is Marlborough with a similar climate but growing different varieties, in this case Sauvignon Blanc. Sauvignon Blanc grown in the southern part of Marlborough's Wairau Valley exhibit a heavier textural mouthfeel, almost certainly from heavier clay-based soils, when compared to other wines from the region. Slate next, and wines grown on slate appear to have a sharper, zingier acidity. Some may say it's minerality, but the effect to me gives a sharpness to the acidity, and can sometimes even feel almost sherbety in the mouth. The last soil type where I think it changes the texture of the wine is limestone. This is often considered to be a good bedrock for wine because it's both permeable, passes water when wet, and porous, stores up water for when it's dry. But it's not just as useful as an insurance against weather, so crucial in Europe where irrigation is banned. Limestone, like slate, gives a sharpness to the acidity, often described again as minerality. Examples of wine on limestone include Champagne and Burgundy. That ends this week's Spotlight. I think we're starting to get really into the meat of terroir, and my own thinking's been developed quite a lot over the last wee while. I think there's probably about one or two more examples to go through, and then we'll wrap up terroir and start applying it to regions of the world. Let's have a look at another clue for the quote, wino forever. As I said earlier, it was originally a tattoo, but it didn't say wino forever. It once read Winona forever. And while quite famous now, this actor, whose earlier work included movies such as Nightmare on Elm Street, Ed Wood, and more lately has become known as a famous pirate. I hope that helps you out. But from pirates to government regulation. Some may say they're just different sides of the same sheet of paper. Next on the show, we have an interview with Bruce Walker on regulation in the wine trade and the highly regulated Canadian market. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm here with Bruce Walker. You are the chairman of the Vintners Association. You also work for Vincor, which are owned by Constellation, which is one of the biggest wine-producing companies in the world. And you are the vice president of government and industrial relations. We're going to talk a wee bit about industrial relations in the wine and dealing with Canadian government. I've been to Canada, and one of the things I noticed was it what seemed, from my point of view, quite regulated. You know, it seemed a lot more regulated, particularly more than the UK and New Zealand and Australia, where I've had most of my experience. Canada is part of the Commonwealth, so I would have thought you'd be more along our lines, a bit more chilled back about these sort of things. Do you want to just comment on regulation in Canada?
Certainly. Canada, as you say, Chris, is a more regulated environment when it comes to alcohol in total, in beverage, whether it's beer or spirits or wine. Every province, and there are 10 provinces in Canada and 3 territories, but speaking of the provinces, all control beverage alcohol sale within their jurisdiction. So at the provincial level, there's a fair significant tax and revenue implication. And also they are responsible to control the distribution and sale of beverage alcohol to ensure that Canadians don't misbehave in their consumption of alcohol, that they are moderate consumers, if you will, and that underage is protected and so forth. So the provinces tend to control and want to continue to control alcohol revenues and therefore alcohol retailing and distribution. There are, in every province, there are different distribution channels of distribution, both retail and wholesale. In Ontario, the government-controlled stores are the Liquor Control Board of Ontario, the largest purchaser of beverage alcohol in the world, the single largest purchaser of beverage alcohol, I believe, in the world. And they have government stores, about 600 government stores in the province. Mm-hmm. And they oversee and control all of the sale of beverage alcohol. Now, within that, the brewers, the beer industry, have their own retail system, which they operate themselves under, again, the control of the province. And the local wine industry actually have 300 and a little over 300 retail stores in which they can sell local wines.
Yep.
And only wines that they produce themselves. So a winery, if it had 15 licenses, could only sell its own wine in those stores.
So wanted to be a wine importer, can I still import wine and sell it in Canada?
Or absolutely.
You can.
But you must go through the Liquor Control Board of Ontario. The Liquor Control Board of Ontario is the only place that an importer can retail their wine, is in the 600 LCBO stores.
And if they don't want to list the wine that I want to import, does it get into the country?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
So, and that's the same in every province. The Liquor Control Boards of each province control listings and distribution channels.
So what happens, does that mean that in Canada you've got a smaller range? Like, one of the great things about the UK is almost every wine in the world is available here if you go looking.
If you travel, I was just going to say, in the province of Alberta, which is our fourth largest province out in Western Canada, it's completely free enterprise retailing. Now, the government of Alberta, the province, still controls the distribution, the warehousing and distribution, but you virtually any import exporter can bring their wine to Alberta, and then it is drawn into the retail system in a normal fashion. So it's almost, what I will say, a private enterprise retail system. And then you get British Columbia, which is a mixture of government stores and private enterprise stores. And then Quebec, where you can sell wine in grocery stores as well as government-controlled stores. So there's quite a mixture. Every province is different.
My experience with Quebec wine shops is they only seem to sell French wines.
There certainly is a high incidence, if you will, or a high percentage of French wine sold in Quebec.
Yeah, so there is a reasonable range of wines.
Oh, there is. And even in Quebec, they pride themselves in the government stores, particularly of carrying high-end wines from around the world, but certainly a predominance of French.
One of the things I find about government regulation is you put a lot of regulation on people, and they just find ways around it. And Canadians are well known for brewing their own wine and beer at home. You know, it is almost like the main hobby. So do you think that this regulation is good in terms of managing people's alcohol consumption, given that they'll just brew a load themselves?
Well, it's another industry in Canada. In the two provinces, whether it's a wine industry, a grape and wine industry, British Columbia and Ontario, it is legal to own a what we call a brew your own or brew on premise, or you know, make your own wine or beer in a shop that has an area for making wine and so forth. So you can go in, buy a kit, a winemaking kit, and start the fermentation process in a barrel and produce, you know, 30 cases or whatever of whatever you want to make legally. Come and take it and take it home. Now, you're only required to pay excise tax, federal excise tax on that wine.
What's the
excise tax? Is the federal, every country has as a what we call an excise tax. It's the way the federal government make money as well.
It's a duty.
So it's a duty. It's a duty so that any time beverage alcohol is made for consumption, it has to pay excise tax.
I've heard stories, and this might be illegal now, but where people can buy grapes and they just do it at home.
Oh, they can, and that's quite legal, and they pay no tax. That's at home, yes. Home winemaking, as you said earlier, is very, very popular in Canada.
Is it good stuff?
Any I've tasted has been of questionable quality.
That'd be because they haven't gone through the Vintners Association.
Right.
Excellent. In terms of your role now dealing with government regulation, all that sort of stuff, obviously you don't want to put yourself in a difficult position here, but do you find that the government's quite easy to work with, or do you find it's a bit like banging your head against a brick wall sometimes?
Well, you know, there are pros and cons to any system, but I would say on balance that for our domestic industry, we are very well treated by the provincial government liquor system, liquor store and distribution system. In most cases, they support the domestic industry to some extent, as we are contributing to the local economy and to the Canadian economy, which is good for us all. So on balance, I'd say it's a positive thing. As a customer, as a retailer, they pay their bills on time. They merchandise well. They're very good retailing merchandisers. So I give credit to every provincial liquor system.
That is quite surprising, given that they're a monopoly. You know, normally monopolies are pretty rubbish.
They take their job seriously. In fact, the president and CEO of the of both the Liquor Board of Ontario and separately the Liquor Board of British Columbia both were retailers in the department store business with the Bay, which is a large department store retailer in Canada, very sophisticated. So there we have people coming from private retail industry into the liquor boards over the last few years. So you have a very sophisticated sales and marketing teams at most of the liquor boards today.
Just touching on the different types of, now more for the wine producers, we talked in a previous interview about Appellation Contrôlée. There's the VQA. Do you want to talk about that? And also a wee bit of, is there any other standards? Like in France, you have AC, Appellation Contrôlée, but you have also Vin de Pays, Vin de Table.
In Canada, there are two labeling ways to go. VQA, which is Vintners Quality Alliance, that's in law, requires that the wines be 100% Canadian-grown grapes and vinted in according to a standard, which is pretty close to the standard of the AOC and the DOC in France and Italy. So we patterned and designed our appellation system very much in terms of what was very successful in Europe. So that would be, so if there's a VQA acronym on the label, the logo stamp on the label, you'll know that's 100% Canadian grown and 100% vinted according to the regulation requirements. There is also a term cellared in Canada, which is the words cellared in Canada by the name of the vintner from either domestic or a combination of domestic and imported grapes. It has to state that on the label, and there is no VQA on those labels, so you know that those wines are at least a blend of local and imported wine. So that's the two different types of wine.
And in terms of VQA, is there any tasting standards or anything like that? Is it more about where the grapes come from than any particular quality standard that they have to reach?
They have to reach not only the quality standard required in terms of vinification, but also both British Columbia and Ontario, the two largest growing regions, have taste panels, which must pass every blend or every wine that that is submitted and have to be submitted to the taste panel.
What happens if they fail the taste?
They don't get VQA status, and they can resubmit rework the wine and resubmit it for another taste panel. I think they can come back three times with the same vintage from the same producer. If it fails a third time, that's it.
It gets dropped down.
And it will not get VQA status. It'll drop to cellared status or a non-VQA. Yes.
Okay. All right. And are you quite happy with how the Canadian system works? You know, do you have much experience with other systems around the world? And what would you say are the pros and cons of your system?
Well, our system, as I said earlier, is patterned very much after the European system, the French.
Not just in terms of your appellation contrôlée, in terms of your whole management of the liquor industry.
The whole issue of retailing and merchandising and so forth. I think we always lean towards private retailing as being a place to go because with less controls. And as a large producer, now I'll speak with Vincor hat on, we'll survive and do very well in any system, I would say. We are very adaptable and I think very able and capable of doing that. We're very familiar with the systems around the world, particularly now with our affiliation with Constellation. Mm-hmm. But we'd already begun to go international prior to that. On balance, though, I would say the system in Canada works very well. Certainly works very well for the domestic industry. And I think for most foreign producers who, once they've achieved listings in a liquor board, are very happy with the system because it continues. The process of ordering and the distribution channels are very well organized.
Yep.
So I think it's a matter, yes, you have to apply for and get a listing, but at the end of the day, once you have your listing, they merchandise you very well and there are many opportunities to promote your wine. So I think the system works well.
Excellent. All right, Bruce, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Bruce. Bruce seemed happy enough with highly controlled and regulated environment. It does look to me, though, that the driver for state control in Canada is less about ensuring quality of service or managing alcohol exposure, but more importantly, to ensure that states have a good income stream. The controls appear mainly to be about making large profits from a monopoly. And it's something that once entrenched with politicians, they become addicted to the cash from the drinks trade. We're pretty much at the end of the show. Next week, we're going to be looking at Rioja and get a handle on this wine region. We're going to be talking with Eduardo Beltran from Fastinio, talking about Rioja. One last thing before I give you the quote and wrap up. I mentioned Montana are running a great wine competition last week, but they've also got a great prize. They're giving away two trips for two to New Zealand. These are all expenses paid trips at harvest time, and you get to explore some of the top wine regions in New Zealand. If you'd like to enter, and I think you should because it's obviously going to New Zealand, be a fantastic trip, you need to go to the website Montana Vintage Experience, that's all one word, montanavintageexperience.com/win. And to finish up this week, we have the quote, who said wino forever? Did you have any joy? Well, not only has this actor been in Platoon and the TV series 21 Jump Street,
It was not until he starred in Pirates of the Caribbean that he started to receive Academy Award nominations. The actor originally tattooed Winona Forever. That was for his girlfriend at the time, Winona Ryder. But since they broke up, the actor has removed it and made it into Wino Forever. Very good name, I think. However, the actor's name, if you're not quite sure who it is yet, is Johnny Depp. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.